welcome to Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast program. The guest this week, comedian, award winner, and all-round class act, David Mills! I love that theme tune. Sounds better every week. Welcome to Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast programme, the show on which I, Ollie Bettesworth, invite London's up-and-coming stand-up comedians round to my flat in lovely, gorgeous, idyllic, sunny, perfect Mitcham in the south of London to sit and have a friendly chat while simultaneously all the while attempting to trick them into saying something either bigoted or libelous. This week, I have the wonderful, amazing, talented American comedian David Mills. He's going all sorts of places. He won the Hackney Empire New Act of the Year Award a few years ago. He's been going from strength to strength, just did a show at the Udderbelly, and it is a terrific episode. Very glad to have him round. A quick disclaimer, though, before we get started, there were a few sound issues I noticed on this one. Nothing too major, still perfectly enjoyable. It's just that I didn't have the old mattress in the corner sucking up the old echoes back then. I didn't have the fancy, high-tech, fascinating setup that I have right now back then. There's also a few sirens that can be heard periodically in the background. There's nothing I can do about that. Hopefully it will give the podcast a sort of urban, gritty, kind of grassroots sort of flavour to it. Anyway, I hope you can forgive it its shortcomings. The structure is much the same as last week when I opened with about 5 minutes talking shop as comedians about shows and gigs before we delve into David's lists of loves and hates. So we're ready. I hope you enjoy episode 2 of Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast programme in which David Mills comes round to discuss dogs, the desert and Twitter liberalism. Enjoy. David Mills, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for making the long, long trip all the way to Mitcham.
Yeah, it's not so bad. I recently thought to myself that I want to leave London anyway. So, I mean, not to come to Mitcham, but, you know, if I were to leave London, I could live somewhere and, like, maybe only take an hour or whatever to get in on the right train line.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to get into this idea of...
You say not Mitcham, but the hour, I mean, it takes half an hour to Victoria from...
Yeah, but I'm not leaving London just to get out of London. I want to go somewhere, and I don't want to go to Mitcham. Wow. You know what I mean? I mean, God love it, but you know what I mean? That's not the idea.
There's an Iceland. I can see the Iceland.
Do you know, actually, it's not terrible around here. I love the little Amen Corner and all that. Yeah, that's
so
quite cool,
backing,
actually.
Backing out of it now because you've hurt my feelings.
I did, actually. That's true as well. But I do kind of like Amen Corner. It's kind of cute.
So, David, how did your show at the Udderbelly go?
It went great. But what I didn't do, I've been doing in 2013 in Edinburgh and also when I was at Soho Theatre, I've been ending on this kind of quiet note. But I knew I couldn't do that in that big room.
Sure.
So I just sort of had to find in all my material to kind of the more upbeat stuff. And then I played a lot with the audience, which a little bit backfired when someone threw a tub of mayonnaise on me, which was a little bit terrifying.
Yeah, you're going to have to expand on that.
Yeah. Well, throughout the show, there was a lot of me playing with the audience, which was going well, but I was sort of this sort of sharp character, as I am, you know, kind of being a bit of a bitch. But fun, right?
Sure.
Hopefully. The Udderbelly's an interesting venue in that if you walk out, you have to walk down the aisle and onto the stage.
Right.
And then walk out, right?
Okay.
So anyone who wants to leave the room, or maybe they just want to get a drink,
has to walk straight.
They
past.
Have to right in front of me and then
right,
out.
Okay.
Well, it didn't strike me that people would just be leaving to get drinks and then coming back. So some people started leaving, and of course I gave them tons of gave him hell and turned it into a joke, whatever. And then they came back and they had a drink for me. It was really nice and funny, and I could turn it into something. But, you know, of course, in the middle of a joke or right before a punchline,
Sure.
So it became a little bit of a thing. And then someone else left. And when he came back, he had chips, fries.
Okay.
In a bag.
So what, he'd gone outside, got some chips, come back?
Come back in.
Who does that?
Well, who knows? Who knows?
That guy does.
And I think because he had seen me be so sharp with so many other people, he just immediately thrust his hand out mm-hmm. with the chips mm-hmm. to offer me one. Of course, this is in the middle of a setup or a punchline or something. My flow is totally ruined. And so in a stupid move, I kind of comically went, wah! And then slammed the chips out of his hands and went flying across the stage. Right?
Mm.
And in his other hand, he had a tub of mayonnaise.
Oh.
And he, in also kind of not thinking, sort of comic rage, threw it at me. So, and it went okay. all across my
You think he
suit.
Was joking, it wasn't revenge.
I think he also didn't, yeah, it was revenge, but he also didn't know what to do in that moment. You know, the whole audience was staring at him. He wasn't like a big bruiser who wanted to attack me. He just didn't know what to do, you know? So now I'm standing there with mayonnaise.
That's
all
kind,
over
of,
my
kind
suit.
Of a gift, though. I mean,
it was a small gift. Mm. It was a big gift, but I didn't know how to play it. It was a little bit, and I use this word with apprehension because I hate to say it, but it's absolutely true. It was a rookie mistake.
Right.
I made a rookie mistake, and I was exposed.
Sure.
I was exposed. This is the biggest room I've ever done, the biggest gig I've ever done, and I was playing it, I was doing it, I was holding it, and then I really exposed myself for the rookie I am.
I think if you'd picked one chip up and thrown at him, that would have been okay.
Well, of course, now I have a million things thinking that I could have done. That
L'esprit
I could,
d'escalier.
Exactly. And I wish I had done. But I somehow, I can't even exactly recall what I did, but I a little bit turned it around and I was able to sort of carry on. And then the show went well. I got the spirit back up and it was almost as if that didn't happen. Right.
Okay.
And, you know, people who know me, because of course I had, you know, I wanted a busy audience, so I said to my friends who'd seen me a million, jillion times, I was like, okay, you are definitely coming. And they're like, oh God, here we go. Okay, we'll see him again. But they're friends of mine, so they're cool. But they said, oh, well, it was a great show. They said, it was a David Mills show. Mm-hmm. Like, we've seen you enough times, and we know when you falter.
Right.
And we know when you don't, and we know when it's you lose control, and we know when you don't.
When
they said,
tips, yeah.
And that's what it was. We saw that, you know. We loved it. But it's what we know about you.
So what's the first thing on your list that you'd like to speak to me about?
On the list of things I hate, dog people.
Why?
I just can't take those people seriously.
Does this come from a dislike of dogs?
No, I love dogs.
But dog people.
Yeah.
Anyone
people who treat their dogs like people.
Okay.
Dogs are dogs. Mm-hmm. Let's not, you know, getting your dog in operation is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not keeping your dog alive just because you can't deal with the fact that dogs die.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's not a person, it is a dog.
Sure, but I mean, if it's an easily fixable little operation and dog could be around for another 5 years.
You know, if it's easily fixable and it's cheap, fine.
It's quite difficult to watch your pet die. No,
you don't have to watch
something.
You never have to watch your pet die.
So just set it free.
No, don't set your dog free. Listen, people, dogs have been put down for centuries.
Okay.
Right, and there are a lot of dogs out there that need a home.
But you also have to pay to put it down.
Well, I know someone who can do it very cheaply.
Okay.
If that's what you're looking for. I mean, listen, I just, you know, I see these people and they take their dog to work and they take their dog to, you know, the gym, and they take their dog everywhere. They spend all their time with the dog. I always feel so bad for the dog having to hang out with that loser all day long. What an idiot. Let your dog be a dog. Leave your dog alone. Mm-hmm. Let it just be a dog. It is not a person. It is a dog, you know? And, you know, dressing your dog up and taking pictures of your dog and your dog eating at the table and all this, both sleeping with the dog, that is disgusting. That is disgusting. It's gross. It's an animal. It's on the floor all day long. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Let the fucking dog be a dog. Let your dog outside. Yeah. It's an animal. Mm. Let it outside to run around outside. Oh, well, we can't let a dog outside. I live in the West End. Well, don't have a dog.
Yeah,
that does don't seem, have a dog.
Does seem a bit cruel if you.
Yeah, you can't have everything you want. Mm-hmm. Yes, I can. I can have a dog, and I can take it with. No, you can't. You can't. Some things you cannot have. But and if you want it, you have to change your life. You have to go live in the country.
But does this not apply to cat people as well?
Yeah, it applies to anyone who. I don't see it as much with cat people, I have to say. Really? But anyone who sort of, what was it, sort of. Turns their, there's a word for it, turning animals into humans.
Anthropomorphizing.
Yeah. Mm. Don't do that.
People that project personalities, yes, and believe, yes, the pet loves them,
yes,
for them.
Yes. Mm. That. It's childish. That's something I really hate, and I think it's rampant. Adults acting like children, right?
Okay.
And I think the, you know, gaming is a lot about it, you know. Having really baby kind of little baby romances with their partner, like we're girlfriends and boyfriends and you know, all that kind of baby shit,
right?
You know, acting like little children. And I think it's people with animals, they act like children with their animals. Mm-hmm. Be an adult. Your dog is a dog, you're an adult, you're in charge. And your dog is not in charge.
Also, your dog is an adult,
and your dog's an adult.
Mm. Exactly. Older than you, in fact.
Yeah.
But it's just companionship, though, isn't it? You could have a baby and make baby noises, and that's just
as... Have a companion your own age. Pick on someone your own size. Mm. You know what I mean? That poor fucking dog having to meet all your needs, having to dress up in funny costumes. You know what I mean? The poor damn thing just wants to sleep on the floor.
Yeah.
And you're making it sleep in your bed with you. Gross. Because you need it.
I don't think I could have a relationship with a dog now. Seems to me, and maybe this is a cat person thing to say, but it seems to me that people that have dogs require an animal that is constantly attentive and enthusiastic about them.
Absolutely.
And I can't respect someone who shows me that much deference. I like the fact that my cats, when they are not in the mood for me, stay the fuck away from me.
Yeah.
And will hiss at me if they want me to go away.
Yeah. And that's how I like all my relationships.
Yeah. How do you know that you've broken ground with someone if they're nice to everyone and they're always nice to you all
Absolutely.
The time?
Absolutely.
And how do you know when someone genuinely...
loves you unless they ignore you.
Exactly, yeah. Or you need to work for it and kind of gradually break down all of their defences until they're yours.
Absolutely.
And then they're yours forever.
Well, that's also terrifying. Mm-hmm. But cats also can turn on you in a good way, you know what I mean? They need their space. Yeah. And I appreciate that about any person, any relationship I have. Someone who is with me when they're with me, but when they're not with me, you know what? They need their space.
There's an awful lot of anti-cat propaganda, especially on the internet. Mm. There's an increasing, you know, one of these zeitgeisty things that come around every now and again that seems to suggest that people that like dogs are the real pet owners. People that like cats are the ones who are really deluded and have these horrible, passive-aggressive relationships.
Yeah.
I feel like with pets, the deal is you make them a kind of life deal. I'll feed you and look after you. You give me cuddles and little bits of validation and we'll be set.
Yeah.
That's the arrangement. Done. I'm happy with that.
Done.
Hmm.
But all this sort of over care, you know, this sort of turning them into toddlers. And I mean, toddlers are over cared for as well, you know, I think, you know, all way too much attention, way too much, the whole world revolves around them. I hate all that. It's, again, it's adults acting like babies. It's not adults being adults, taking responsibility for themselves, realizing that their child or their dog is a separate being that can stand on its own, that needs to grow up on its own, that occasionally needs to experience heartbreak or disappointment or challenge in life. It's instead some adult projecting or seeing in that child or that dog any hurt, any pain, any discomfort somehow is their own discomfort.
How would you measure heartbreak in a dog?
Well, you know, when a dog is attracted to another dog and that other dog ignores them, or...
That doesn't happen.
No, I'm just kidding.
That's what's great about the dog world.
And, you know, these people give their dogs everything they want.
They're fucking animals, you know? Animals don't get everything they want. And you're turning them into weird monsters when they get every single thing they need and they live in the lap of luxury and all this. It's gross.
So what's next? What do you want to talk to?
The desert.
The desert. And yeah. Is this love or hate?
Love. Mm-hmm. I don't know. The only kind of desert I really know is Southern California.
Right.
L.A. and east of L.A. into the desert. And my parents live in a town called Claremont, sort of driving towards Palm Springs from L.A.
Okay.
And, we moved there when I was like 18. And we stayed there because we had moved around quite a bit prior to that. And we stayed there. But I didn't stay there. I went down to San Diego and did my university there. And then I went to San Francisco. And then I went to New York. And then I came to London. So, of course, I know L.A. a little bit, but not really well. It's not like I have friends there or spend a lot of time there. But anyway, now when I go home, I go to my parents in Claremont, outside L.A. Anyway, I was just back there recently, and it was just so beautiful. The desert is stunning. And, you know, you have to be away from somewhere for a long time before your eyes open up, because you can also say, oh, it's really empty, which, of course, it's empty. It's a desert, right? Mm. There's just not a lot going on. It's a desert. But so naturally really beautiful. I mean, it's a suburb, so massive freeways and all that stuff, but it's got this kind of cool, dry, empty kind of end-of-the-world quality, which I really, really love. And I've been thinking of becoming like one of these weird old desert gays, you know what I mean? Like, get like an old house out
there. You say that as though that's a recognized...
That's an archetype.
That's not what
I'm... The desert gay.
The desert gay?
The desert gay.
Is there something I need to be worried about?
Well, not worried. They're largely harmless.
Okay.
You know? But, you know, all the desert people, they're really into, like, don't get too close. And because, you know, they're desert people. They need a lot of space around them. And they, you know, have like a rock garden in the back of their house. You know what I mean? It's all one. Like, what do they call it here? Like a bungalow, all one story. You know what I mean? And I'll be some sort of desert gay, you know, kind of smoke a lot of weed and have my rock garden and, you know, maybe grow a beard or something like that. And, you know, play old records, and like all the, you know, weirdos will come hang around my place from the neighborhood, like some sort of weird sort of...
Other desert gays.
Not just other desert gays, but like weird sort of outcast kind of like, I'm going to get into being that weirdo like in the neighborhood, like all the kind of the refugees hang out with and the kind of like social outcasts. But I've got like this amazing flat or house and like all these old records and, you know...
Any open mics out in the desert?
No.
Mm-hmm. No. It's part of the appeal.
No open mic, none of that.
So what's stopping you? When's this plan going to come to
fruition?
Well,
I'm thinking I need to make a lot of money in order to do that. So I've got to make a lot of money somehow and then move out to the desert.
You could be like Alexander Supertramp.
Who's that?
He's that guy, they made a film about him, Into the Wild. Sean Penn directed it.
Oh, right.
With Emil Hirsch.
Yeah.
And I don't know the full story, but it essentially seems to be some guy who claimed himself to be the ultimate homeless traveller type guy.
No.
And he went out into the wilderness and died in a bus.
No, I'm not interested in that.
No.
No, I'm going to, you know... I'm into the look of it and the style of it. Okay. I'm not going to be homeless. There's going to be a community around me of weirdos and maybe a little bit of heroin, but not much. You know what I mean? That's on the you know, I'll know those people, and they're allowed as long as they behave. You know what I mean? Like, I'm thinking of barbecues, late night barbecues, going late.
You're not supposed to be doing peyote in the desert.
A little bit of peyote, maybe. Mm. Sure, there's that.
When in Rome.
Exactly. Weed, you know, maybe... Talk to the little animals and things.
I had never seen this side of you, Dave.
Yeah.
You've always seemed to me to be quite a cosmopolitan.
I am, but there's another side coming out, the desert gay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little bit William Burroughs meets...
So is that going to be where you end up, or is this just a sort of a passing fancy of a dream?
I don't know.
Is this actually part of the... Part of the future. 20-year plan.
Yeah, maybe I think I got to find someone to kidnap to go with me.
So he's with me, and the two of us.
You did mention the kidnap.
But... Well, not kidnap, but you know, someone who's also into the idea. Mm-hmm. And we sort of like set up how homesteading. We like homestead out there. I mean, we're not far from some sort of community, but maybe in the distance, there's a freeway. And you see, and you sort of hear in the distance that sort of distant freeway sound all the time.
Civilization still
even exists. Even at night, like massive old truck, massive big like 18-wheeler, just sort of distant sound of that. Isn't that cool? And then like big black sky with stars and sort of a desert gay. That's my future.
I feel it's difficult because it's using such beautifully evocative language, and you're gesticulating, and you're really making it come alive. It feel quite. It's quite difficult for me to piss all over it now.
You don't need to.
I'd feel bad.
You don't need to.
But I also feel bad not doing that.
Why? Why would you? Why would you want to? You need to open yourself up to the desert, Ollie.
Yeah.
The desert inside of you. Embrace emptiness. Mm-hmm. Embrace it. Dive in. It's beautiful. And then come out to the desert. Will you have a spare room? Mm-hmm. You can stay for a few months if you want. I mean, I'm not going to pay for everything, but, you know, there's always someone staying, some weird runaway or, you know, middle-aged hippie lady, or you know what I mean? And we're hanging out, getting stoned, eating great food, communing with the animals, desert gays, maybe doing pottery, maybe throwing, maybe, who knows?
This seems to me the type of perspective that you would usually mock. I would assume this sort of wishy-washy back to nature, talking to the animals. You just railed about how dogs are just animals and we shouldn't be communing with them at all.
No, I disagree with that. You know, have a mature relationship with the dog.
You discuss politics.
No. Just don't treat a dog like a child.
Mm-hmm. A bit more like, well, mate, you know.
Yeah, you're an adult. You want to get stoned at the barbecue, you can.
The dog.
Yeah.
Right.
It's an adult dog, not a puppy.
I don't think a dog is capable of making that choice, giving consent.
See, this is what we always say about dogs, isn't it? This is what we always say about children and dogs. You know, they're powerless. Huh? Dogs have been around for a very long time.
Are dogs allowed on your desert retreat?
Yeah.
Wild ones, though, only wild ones.
Wild dogs. Mm-hmm. No one bring in a little dog. That's a little pampered little baby. Mm. No babies allowed. No children. It's only adults.
I would visit if it weren't for the kidnapping aspect.
I'm not going to kidnap you. I'm not going to kidnap anyone. I did say
the word kidnap. I have it on tape.
You have it on tape. I'm not... Okay, yeah. Here's the truth about me. I'm a kidnapper. That is true. You've exposed me, Ollie. It's true. I'm a kidnapper. I've been kidnapping for decades.
Decades.
Yeah.
This is all just a front.
It's all a front.
We kidnap someone from every show.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's what I have in my desert. People in the house. People all sort of in different rooms that I've kidnapped.
I just turned up at the Soho Theatre.
Yeah, that's scary. Hmm. But, you know, it's the desert. Crazy shit happens out there. Do you know what? I'll probably have a gun. I will. I will have a gun. Because, you know, it's a desert. With all sorts of characters.
Off the grid.
Yeah, off the grid.
Survivalist.
Well... Not so much survivalist, but prepared.
But if anyone tries to come on your land?
Of course I welcome them with open arms. Hmm. But if they...
Bring a dog.
The gun comes out.
A pampered dog.
Yeah.
One in the chihuahua's face.
Yeah, forget it.
One in their face.
They're asking for it. Who would blame me?
Unmarked graves in the desert.
What? To dust we shall return.
About something that you love.
K-pop.
Pop music from Korea.
K-pop.
Expand.
But it's more than just the music, it's a whole culture.
Okay. So you're talking about Gangnam Style?
No, I'm not talking about Gangnam Style.
And what's so wrong about Gangnam Style?
Well, I mean, I liked Gangnam Style before it became overplayed. But, you know, it's just Gangnam Style. A lot of people who don't know K-pop think that's what K-pop is.
So you had heard of K-pop before?
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was under the impression that was the birth of K-pop. I think a lot of people...
You knew it wasn't the birth of K-pop. You're crazy.
There was probably some music made in Korea before Gangnam Style, but it wasn't that.
Oh my God, K-pop is a huge industry and has been for a decade or more.
Do you prefer K-pop to J-pop?
I do.
And why is that?
J-pop I find derivative of K-pop.
Okay.
A little bit. And I also think that... it doesn't seem to have a sense of humor about itself the way that K-pop does.
So if you heard a J-pop song, would you know that it was not K-pop?
I don't know. I have to... Maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't. But also the videos usually give it away.
Okay.
And frankly, a lot of J-pop are Korean bands. I mean, here's the thing about the big Korean bands. They sing in Korean, they sing in Chinese, and they sing in Japanese. Mm-hmm. Because K-pop has become such a phenomenon. And those stars have become so big all over Asia. They now record in, like a hit song, they'll record in three different languages. And for example, there's a band called Super Junior, right? Mm-hmm. Who I love, Super Junior, and have loved for a long time. Super Junior, 13. It's a 13-man boy band.
Okay, right? I thought you were going to say 13-year-old boys.
No, they're not 13. But there's 13 of them. Mm-hmm. And then they have a subgroup called Super Junior M, which is Super Junior, Mandarin, and it's about like seven of them that just sing in Mandarin. So they take that whole Super Junior kind of style and aesthetic that they've developed. Minus six of them. And they do that stuff, but in Mandarin.
So you're missing six of the musicians.
They're not musicians.
Mandarin.
They're not musicians.
I would feel shortchanged.
Well... they're pretty great. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there is an argument that says 13 is overkill anyway. And, you know, they're Korean, so they've all got military service. So always one is gone for a year or two, you know. And so, and they're all styled to look exactly alike anyway. So it's hard to know sometimes which one you're looking at.
I see. And some people might have considered that to be a racist statement, David.
Styled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is a real kind of, not enforced, but... certainly in K-pop, they're all going for the same look. And many of them get plastic surgery in order to get that look. So it's not, again, you know, it's not racist to say they look alike because they look alike. Mm-hmm. They actually do. And, you know, Asian people are like, oh, God, I can't deal with K-pop. All those people look alike.
Okay, right? So it's the sort of the sense of humor. It's the cultural alienation that you feel from it. You don't, you know... It's sort of
I get it and I don't get it, right? It's sort of like all that kind of Western pop music stuff filtered through this sort of weird... It's a little bit like Eurovision, right? You know, when you watch Eurovision, you're like, I know that pop song, but I don't know what's going on here somehow. Like, see, I've seen all those conventions, but this is a weird take on it.
See, when I first heard the original and best K-pop song, Gangnam Style, you didn't know whether it was parody. I didn't know whether it was meant to be taken seriously. It seemed like one of those internet oddities. And some of the other videos that I've seen are similar. Like, what am I watching?
Yeah, that's what I love about it. And then some are really, really close to what we know of pop music. And it doesn't feel that far away. Mm-hmm. And then some feel much more about a Korean conversation that you don't really know. But anyway, so I'm a huge fan of K-pop, and I would recommend to people Crayon Pop, this band. They've done a lot of shit, but they're great, great, great song and great videos called Bar, Bar, Bar.
Okay, well, we're going to have a look at that. Let's start this off. All right, so we're looking at five Korean teenage girls.
Maybe 20s.
They look quite young to me. It's certainly... certainly sound young as well.
Yeah, well, that's the look, isn't it? And it's, again, it's for, like, teenage girls and me. Okay.
Have you got any idea what they're singing about?
No, I have no idea.
And that's part of the appeal as well?
Well, I guess, maybe. I haven't thought of it that way.
Well, maybe if you could hear what they were talking about, it would be something really banal and annoying.
It's clearly something banal and annoying.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, good thing they're Korean.
Hilarious.
I mean, it's very joyous and upbeat. Is there any K-pop that's kind of introspective and...
On the pop scale, so it's not that introspective, but on the pop scale, it can mirror the kind of Adele-ish kind of stuff. But, you know, I mean, it's still pretty disposable.
Sure.
But hilarious, look at them.
I mean, it seems innocuous enough. They do seem
innocuous. It is innocuous, but I think it's kind of refreshing because it's, the style of it is so weird. The fashion is weird.
It's colorful.
It's colorful. They're wearing crash helmets.
It appears to be celebratory.
It was completely unexplained. There's no reason for it. You know, it seems weird, right? And they're sort of in sports day outfits, maybe?
Mm.
And
which is hot.
Is it?
I thought that was part of the...
What
they were going for.
I think maybe you're imposing that. I don't think it's sort of been made for, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think it's been made for sort of like guys to wank off about. It's not like...
It's the pedophile pound. It's a very strong emerging market.
I think that's true, but I don't think that's what this is made for. I think this is made for a bunch of teenage girls.
Okay.
Right? I think it's not like Kesha? Whoever
yeah,
that is.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's like writhing around on the floor.
Well, it's her real name is $.
Yes, exactly. I don't think it's that. I think it could be someone could come at it with kind of a sexual thing, but I don't think that's the intention. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they are trying to be that way. But I think a lot of K-pop's like that. It's sort of unintentionally sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of it's trying to be sexy, but that's a little bit less successful, I think.
Right.
I like the stuff that's sort of...
Korean people are only ever unintentionally erotic.
No. That's not true either. That's not true either. But
what a curse!
They're sort of it's sort of funny because they're young and they're trying to be sexy, and I always think it's sort of hilarious. Mm. You know.
Any plans to visit Korea?
No.
Go to some concerts?
No, not really.
No. You and all the teenage Korean guys.
Yeah, that. But probably, you know what, it would probably kill it for me.
Yeah.
Actually, I'd like to go to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to go to Japan, but Korea, I've heard actually Seoul is a really ugly city, and maybe the countryside's great or something. I don't know. I don't know that much about it.
Stay away from the north.
I know someone who went to the north
and
said they're really little people because they're not well nourished and super, super weird, as you can imagine, the hermit kingdom.
I wonder if they believe that the stuff that they're told about Kim Jong-un, you know, he went on this trip and he scored the perfect game of bowling, and then he slayed a dragon, and he won the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah.
And he came home.
It's amazing what people believe.
Yeah. All right, well, we're coming to your last choice. Describe.
Well, when you asked what I hate, I was sort of on some sort of Twitter rampage or something.
Okay.
And I was hating the kind of liberal language police.
Okay. What was happening?
Well, you might not know this. You know, I mean, it mirrors so many of these Twitter dust-ups that come and go with regularity and make very little impact outside of that moment.
The Twitterverse, yeah.
Yeah.
Seems like things move insanely quickly.
Yeah, thankfully, in a way, because some of them are so stupid.
I'm quite glad I'm not really involved, because it seems so much to keep on track of.
Well, it's worth staying uninvolved.
Mm.
Yeah, it's really not worth getting into it, even though it's hard sometimes not to engage, because it's an easy way to engage. It's easy to... I mean, you can engage without much effort or much stickiness.
Or much provocation sometimes. If someone just pushes that button.
Yeah, exactly.
They have to be told they're wrong.
Yeah, that need. You know.
I'm getting to the point where I'm really proud of myself whenever I don't
get
involved in the discussion.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so pleased with myself that I managed to resist, you know, spending the next hour justifying and then waiting for their reply and then picking holes in that argument and then backwards and forwards until we call each other names and then block each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I fall into it too regularly, and I don't fall into it that much, to be honest. But even the amount that I do is too much. It's dumb, it's childish, and it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean a thing. You can call someone out. You can be absolutely 100% right and feel justified. It still doesn't mean anything. So anyway, this was there was someone going on about how drag was an insult to women, and you know it's. And you know, listen, I'm not like a drag champion of drag. I have tons of problems with drag, you know.
But you don't need to in order to see that statement silly.
Exactly, exactly. I said, you know, this is typical sort of like identity warriors turning clowns into terrorists.
And that's the thing, is you it's this term, intersectionality.
Please.
But it seems like intersectionality is an interest. I think it, with the right people, it's an interesting topic. The idea that whose sense of injustice and oppression triumphs over someone else's. So an interesting case, in fact, you talk about drag being an insult to women, there are feminists who see trans people, trans men, as being just another example of the patriarchy.
Yeah.
A man wants to control or claim the female identity.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's interesting that, you know, you find these... So, it all happens at these intersections where different people believe that their plight and their buzzwords or their agendas are the most important.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's very little today about coalition building, actually identifying empathy with other struggles and building together. Do you know what I mean? It's all about, as you point out, trying to trump one another with, I'm more oppressed. My oppression is more important than your oppression.
Yeah.
Instead of, what are our shared... And then our shared enemy just carries on. Well, the left, essentially, splinters and fights within itself and battles within itself, you know what I mean? And then the corporate, military, corporate... hegemony, is that the word? Hegemony?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just sort of rumbles on, you know, and no one really challenging it because everyone's so sort of, you know, exercised about the fact that their specific identity wasn't recognized on Twitter. You know what I mean? It's like, you are nuts. You people are crazy. Oh, well, you would say that, whitey. Yeah, okay, now I can't say anything because I'm white. All right. So now everything, and a man.
I was once told, on that subject, I was told by a feminist I was disagreeing with on a specific issue. Not disagreeing with feminism, just a specific issue that we're talking about.
Yeah.
She said to me, because there were two people, in fact, her and another woman who were having a go at me. She said, if two feminists who are women tell you you're wrong about this, you are wrong.
Yeah.
By definition.
Yeah, yeah, right.
So a woman's opinion on a feminist issue is always right over mine, no matter how stupid they are.
Yeah.
So I just thought, even on those terms, what if two female feminists disagree with each other and I agree with one of them? Am I still wrong? You know, even logically, even in terms of a thought experiment, that doesn't
work. It's so childish and dumb. You know, but it's funny because these are things... This kind of language, this kind of discourse was stuff that I was seeing at university in the 90s. And we're talking 1992, right? I mean, 91, 92, that era. And that was sort of all in this sort of world of academia, and I was seeing it, you know, friends and I were engaged in this kind of discourse and conversation and bullshit, really. And then, like, 2 decades of sort of not really hearing about it. It was sort of around on the fringes or whatever. But now it's, boom, moved totally into the mainstream and been totally bastardized and popularized and loaded up with all this, these agendas. And it just feels really old school and really already deeply irrelevant.
And that's it. But the thing is, it's frustrating because I find that most of the time, just broadly speaking, I agree.
Yes, with them. Yes, I think that's right.
And that having problems with certain feminists is not the same thing as being anti-feminism or denying that feminism still has a place,
yeah,
or a purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same with anything. There are real struggles to take place and to be involved with.
I totally agree.
Every time one of these issues comes up, I mean, you know, what's that expression? The emptiest vessels make the most noise. Mm. You'll get the worst components of every argument shouting the loudest,
yeah,
until it becomes just a sort of mishmash of name-calling and,
yeah,
you know, you're a bigot. No, you're a bigot.
Yeah. Blah, blah, blah. Oh, God, it's so dumb. It's like the...
And it seems so easy to trip up as well. To not use the right word is
It's all... Again, it's this whole sort of language policing and using the wrong word, almost like... Like on a game show, like a buzzer, zzz, and you're out.
Mm.
You use the wrong word, so your entire argument, your entire thinking, everything you were saying, we're not going to listen to because you used the wrong word.
Not only that, but you're like a bigoted, misogynistic...
Absolutely. And how are people supposed to know the words? Well, anyway.
They make them up.
Exactly. It's sort of this closed society that decides, and you're ignorant because you don't know their words. Well, wait a minute. How's anyone supposed to know them? We're all supposed to know these words.
We don't all have time to sit in front of Twitter all day and debate these
exactly.
topics.
It's complete...
Some people have to go to work.
Yeah.
It is annoying because it seems like, you know, ignorance is, you know, it doesn't give you a carte blanche to say or do whatever you like, but it's not the same as hatred. And it seems to me that if you're throwing words around like bigotry or racism... or homophobia or whatever, you better be sure that the person you're throwing it at is acted out of hatred and spite rather than just, you know, naivety.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know,
you're only going to alienate people if you come at them all guns blazing.
One thing I always, maybe it's not so relevant, but somehow in my mind it kind of, I return to it. You know, I always think the big mistake... that George Bush made. Of course, he made a lot of mistakes.
Mm.
But the big mistake that George, in my mind, one of the biggest was when everything kicked off and 9/11, all that bullshit, he engaged the extremists, extreme Islam. He engaged those people.
Okay.
Right? Instead of engaging moderate Islam. Right?
I see, yeah.
And so declaring war on extreme Islam, he sort of raised...
Slightly radicalized the moderates.
Well, no, he sort of legitimized extreme Islam.
Mean.
Well, that's no surprise because he was also an extremist, George Bush, right? He was not a moderate. He's extremist.
Yeah.
Also an American fundamentalist, right? So it was a battle of fundamentalists against each other. It wasn't, he doesn't understand the moderate. So had he instead... You know, maybe there was some military thing that had to happen to some degree. But if he had largely engaged moderate Islam and tried... And it was a moment when he could have, because there was great sympathy for what happened to a degree. And he could have built bridges and educated himself and educated the West and tried to really find points of commonality. Together, those moderate forces, I think, could have... clamp down on extreme forces both in the US and in the West and in Islam. That's perhaps idealistic, but that's another approach that he could have taken. And I think this is so true. You see this battle all the time on Twitter and in these things all the time. These people who claim to be feminists, instead of trying to make arguments and engage with sort of moderate people who may have some confusion or some level of ignorance or whatever, they immediately get extreme and they call them extreme and then they engage all those crazy extremists like Fred Phelps and Nigel Farage and all these total extremists. And now they're totally irrelevant and they're in the battle that they want to be in and they get to, you know, be warriors and all that bullshit. And meanwhile, all the moderate people are ignoring them.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's listening to their stupid battle. And I think, I don't know if that argument is totally cogent.
No, I know
anything,
what you mean.
Anyway.
I mean, feminism is a very good example, it seems to me, because there are a lot of moderates.
Yeah.
People who just don't really think about it much. And I think, you know, if you haven't really looked into it and you don't talk about this sort of thing with people very often, it can be easy to sort of go, well, there's, you know, there's laws in place now, things are more or less equal, why do we still need feminism, you know, what does it even mean? And just to have that approach to it, it doesn't mean that you're misogynistic, doesn't mean that you're anti people sticking up for themselves.
Yeah.
It just means that you haven't really thought of it. And maybe if someone came along and was like, well, you know, think about this, and actually there's stuff to engage with here, and I think there's still a reason feminism to exist for these reasons, you might actually get an ally rather than, you know,
or
another person who just thinks that all feminists are humanless, horrible, kind of pedantic pricks.
Yeah, but then a lot of those same people, when they experience these issues in context in their daily lives, actually, they are feminists.
Yeah.
But they don't see it that way because these extremists have not engaged them in sort of contextual experiences and how it works and in a daily way. And also, they demonize people for having a sense of humor around these issues.
Absolutely.
No one can have any sense of humor. There's no room for humor in any of this debate. Well, we all know in reality, people have humor around gay stuff. People have humor around race stuff. People have humor around sexuality stuff, around gender stuff, on both sides.
A really good example of this is when they, remember there was a time last year when rape jokes was the big issue.
Yeah.
There's a feminist on Jezebel, which to my mind seems to sum up everything that's wrong with online feminism.
Mm.
But she's called Lindy West.
Okay.
And she wrote, you know, some blog or other about rape jokes. And then there was a comedian, I forget which comedian it is, but if you search on YouTube, Lindy West rape jokes,
it's
on W. Kamal Bell's show.
Oh, yeah, I know Kamal Bell.
Now, he was just arguing that the basic comedian argument, she was arguing the basic feminist argument about how rape jokes, you know, no one's banning them, but if you make them, I reserve the right to call you a prick. That was her argument.
Right.
Because, you know, it's not funny. But the irony was that in talking about this, because there was a general sort of bantery, light-hearted, comical kind of tone to the show, she made a rape joke on the show discussing how rape jokes are no good and that context doesn't matter. And but there she is, the feminist herself, caught up in humour, proving that in context, with the right people, with the right trust in the room, this subject can be approached.
Yeah.
And that she wasn't immediately kind of set upon by people. She wasn't called a hypocrite, but she also, to my mind, didn't get any kind of flack from feminists saying, you know.
All topics. Can be approached.
Mm.
All topics. And then for people to ban the Holocaust or rape or gay bashing or AIDS or anything is just, I think, showing their own fundamentalism.
Mm.
Which doesn't interest me.
Well, it does seem increasingly that when you see, you know, you look around, the people that more often than not are sort of fighting free speech are, ironically, more often than not liberal now. It seems as though, in terms of people objecting to other people, you can't say that, you can't say that, you can't joke about that, you can't do this, you can't. It seems like it's now become the liberal agenda to tell people what to do and what to think and what to say, how to say it.
I'd say the left wing agenda. It's
the left wing.
The left wing agenda. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But again, this is, you know, this is so, I see this so much in America. There's a real fine line between the Fred Phelps Christian warriors and the left-wing progressive warriors as well. You know, they're fundamentalists on both sides. They're warriors. They love being at battle. That's what they mostly are. Warriors.
Point scoring.
Yeah.
It's about finding the weaknesses in the other person's argument all the time.
Yeah.
Not trying to find common ground.
Yeah. The struggle.
Yeah.
They revere the struggle over all else. They're not interested unless they're part of the struggle and you're part of the struggle. And what's your role in the struggle? And what are you doing? What have you done today to smash homophobia? Or, you know what? Nothing. I could use a little homophobia.
And by that time, they've built up so much of a head of steam, so much of a personality in the media, maybe, depending on who they are, they cannot now back down.
No, it's part of their identity.
Now they have to keep.
Yeah.
Even if they saw some piece of evidence and they changed their mind, most of them wouldn't come forward and say...
No, it becomes about their media persona.
Mm.
You know, and what I just find so
hilarious about it is their absolute conviction that they're so important and they're making such an impact. And if they don't say it, it won't be... Someone has to stand up.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, thanks. They're on the front line. Thanks for making that contribution. Yeah, mm-hmm. On the front line, exactly.
And logged into Twitter.
Yeah.
Fighting a war.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you do run the risk of saying this kind of stuff of coming across like the, oh, political correctness gone mad brigade, which is another bunch of people that you might not want to be associated with.
Well...
Oh, you can't even be racist anymore. Oh.
You know, I'm of the thinking that... how do I want to say this? I think everyone should... I just don't believe a lot of stuff matters. Like we were talking about earlier, you know, what do you love, what do you hate? Actually, not a lot.
Mm.
Not much of it matters. If someone calls you a faggot, it doesn't matter. It's not going to destroy me, and it's not going to destroy you.
Mm.
Let's put that one to rest. That being called names is soul-destroying. It's not. People have been called names for decades and decades and hundreds of years. And you know what? They rose above it. It's not that difficult to do. It's all these people who think that what happened on the playground defined them.
Mm.
You know what defines you on the playground? When you rise above it.
Mm.
Not when you sink into it and let it destroy you. Oh, God. You know? And so then they go through all their life never learning to rise above. Never learning to, I shouldn't have to hear that word. No one should ever call me a faggot. Guess what? Sometimes people are going to call you things that you don't like. That's going to happen to everyone. Gingers, faggots, women, fat people, skinny people, people with freckles, black people. Everyone gets it.
Especially gingers.
Especially gingers. Mm. Yeah. Everyone gets it.
No one cares about them.
Yeah. Everyone gets it. People with... You know, everyone. Rich people, poor people. Where's people in wheelchairs.
Where's my liberal word police for gingers, by the way? When's that coming? I'm waiting for that.
But you've risen above it. It didn't destroy you.
Well, no one cared. So I had to learn how to rise above it. No one came to my rescue.
Well,
so you
good.
Sort of have to figure out how to...
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You have to grow up. And you know what grown-ups do? They let things slide.
You know, I just don't buy it when people start claiming all this identity shit, how hard it is, how difficult it is. It isn't that hard. I don't believe you. Mm. I really don't believe it. And I know they say, oh, well, you're white privilege. You're not my white privilege. A lot of people who looked and experienced just what you experienced rose above it and did it just fine in the world.
See, that's another one. Check your privilege, that phrase.
Oh, fuck off.
I mean, again, it's one of those really irritating things where the initial thought, I agree with, I think there's some legitimacy there, that when you're talking generally about oppression or inequality, to be mindful of your own perspective and whether or not you've had it easier or whether you've had any direct experience in the way that those people have, and to be aware that maybe you don't want to talk for other people, maybe you don't want to talk to other people's experiences, and to be aware where you've had it lucky as opposed to... I'm totally on board with that. But when it's thrown at someone, check your privilege, i.e. your
Close
point,
down the conversation.
Exactly. Your point is illegitimate because you're white, male, able-bodied, straight, whatever. Therefore, I mean, the frustrating thing is, apart from ginger, which we all know is irrelevant, no one cares, I have nothing. No struggle, no...
That doesn't mean I don't have a valid perspective.
No, but I'm the establishment. In all of these arguments, I no matter what it is... I can be quite easily in a few tweets turned into the enemy.
Yeah, exactly. But this is this idea that you can only speak with authority about your experience, which I also don't believe.
Mm.
We have shared experience. Let's stop talking about what we don't share. Let's start talking about what we do share as humans.
That's the thing.
Do you know what I mean?
All of these arguments
we
just
all experience privilege at one time or another. Right? Maybe in this conversation we could look at it and say, oh, you're privileged because you're this and you're this. But then take that person who's not privileged in that situation, put them in another situation, and then they're the privileged one. Mm. So don't tell me you don't know what it means in that specific way of talking about privilege to be privileged. And that doesn't mean you can't, like, all sorts of people can talk about the gay experience, even if they're not gay.
Mm.
They've studied it, they've learned it, they've intuited it, whatever.
I'm okay with that. Cool. What do you got to say about it? Bring it. I'll bring my thing and we'll find something in the middle.
It's the suggestion that people are so different and so, their experiences are so...
Completely radically, you would never understand. Actually...
There's no overlap.
I think that's complete bullshit. It's like if and it, all it does is give you privilege.
Yeah.
Sets your opinion in this place that it has all this authority and no one else can speak to it because you've got some sort of inside knowledge. Yeah, I thought we were getting away from that idea across the board.
Yeah. Yeah, that we're all so different and, you know, if a black guy came in here, it would just be like two different worlds.
Yeah, yeah.
He would be
you would never know.
About his childhood and I'd be like, what?
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Crazy dinner time, you say. What did you do at dinner time?
Yeah, 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 yeah. I don't believe that one. I don't believe it. But people love to talk about that, how unique and different, and especially how no one understands.
Identity politics.
I hate all that shit. I hate it. It's so old-fashioned. It really is. And it's sometimes I really believe it, that we're at its absolute, in its death throes, this whole identity politics bullshit. And I hope the next thing that comes isn't worse, which it may be. But it's the kind of twittering of a bunch of mostly coddled people who have life pretty fucking easy.
That's the thing. If I got the impression that it was a whole bunch of people discussing these things to find a way of negotiating these issues in a more compassionate and integrated way, then I would be totally on board to be like, what a great use of the internet to have a whole bunch of people from different backgrounds coming together, negotiating these issues together. But it isn't that. It is a whole bunch of people trying to outdo themselves in displays of liberalism.
Yeah, and trying to build careers as, you know, advocates or spokespeople or media careers. It's a bunch of nonsense. You know what? All those people can put food on the table. They're not starving. We live in this sort of easy lifestyle of the West. You know what? When the world is on fire and when there's no water coming in the next 20 years or whatever it is, then let's talk about your experience as a whatever your identity is. Fuck you, off. It's about okay. Being humans.
You'll be in the desert.
I'll be in the desert. Yeah. Cat lady in the desert. That's you. We'll communicate through flashing lights across the desert. You know. We'll
and that'll be the only conversation you can ever have.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, David, for making the trip and sharing your loves and hates.
Well, thank you, Ollie, for giving me the opportunity. I'm confident there's a whole world of people just sitting on the edge of their seat waiting to hear what I love and hate. So I was thrilled to be able to, you know, I do it for the fans mostly. I do, you know, I just want my fans to be happy.
Yeah. Well, I think you've made them very happy.
Yeah, I must have.
Thanks for joining me for the second episode of Ollie Bettesworth's downloadable weekly podcast program with the marvellous David Mills. I hope you enjoyed the show. A little bit of business before we end. You can now find us on iTunes, so if you wish to subscribe on there and automatically download every episode as it's released every Friday morning, you can do so. And we're now also on Stitcher Radio, although I'm not entirely sure what that is. But Ollie, we've enjoyed the show so much, we feel this desperate desire to pay you back in some way and show our appreciation. Well, you can. If you go onto the iTunes page, please do leave us a rating or even a little comment, depending on your time commitment, and it would really help us find new listeners. Next week, we have got the excellent Gareth Moran, and it was a really terrific episode. I really enjoyed it, so please do join me. I'll see you then. Bye! This week, we have the lovely and talented David Mills on the show, an American stand-up comedian that's going all sorts of places. Just did a sellout show at the Ball Bag Theatre in central Anustown.
the show on which I, Ollie Bettesworth, invite London's up-and-coming stand-up comedians round to my flat to shit...